Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by that date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
Today we're going to rattle through two interesting news stories or research, scientific research that's come out that we wanted, that we thought would be interesting to kind of pull some challenging ethical questions out of and discuss for a while. The first one is one you found, Dad. It's a study about something called polygenic embryo screening. I suspect, like me, most people listening have never heard of this before. So could you explain what on earth polygenic embryo screening is, and then we'll get on to what does the study look at?
Yeah, so one of the consequences of IVF, which is often not recognized so much, is that before IVF, it wasn't possible to do anything to the human embryo in terms of testing or so on. But once you have the process of IVF, you create an embryo in a laboratory, and that means it is now possible to do a whole range of tests on the embryo, or on a whole series of embryos before they're re-implanted. And this is already carried out, so it's in the standard method of doing IVF. The mother is given hormones to cause her to so-called hyperovulate, to make a large number of eggs, as opposed to the normal monthly cycle when only one egg is generated per month. And those eggs are, quote, harvested and then analysed in the laboratory. They're matched with the sperm, and then under the microscope, the embryologists look at the embryos, and they immediately put them in different qualities, into high quality and low quality embryos, depending on whether they seem to be developing normally. But it is now possible to do a whole range of genetic screening, and up until recently, the only kind of genetic screening that was carried out was single gene testing or looking for chromosomal abnormalities. Now it's possible to do what's called polygenic screening, which means effectively you look at the whole genome, the entire genetic code for each embryo, and then you develop risk scores for that, for each particular embryo. What are the risk scores for a large range of conditions, such as physical conditions like diabetes and hypertension and cancer, different forms of cancer, but also psychiatric conditions like depression, schizophrenia, dementia, and also other things like height and intelligence and a whole range of other human characteristics.
And so just to make it clear, so sometimes in popular culture, people talk about the something gene, you know, the breast cancer gene or the eye color gene. But actually, that's a bit misleading, because what we now understand is that our physical traits or our propensities to various things are actually caused by the interplay of multiple genes. So you can't just look at a genome and say, if an embryo has X or Y gene, they will be tall or have red hair. You actually need to look across the entire genome to see, do they have collections of different genes that we now know, when an embryo has all of these genes, they might have a certain percentage likelihood to develop one of these things.
That's correct. In fact, the total number of genes is relatively small. It's thought to be, in the order of 20,000 genes, which produce different genes, which produce proteins, which is interestingly less than some other organisms. Some other organisms have more genes than we do. What turns out is that it's subtle variations in each of those 20,000 genes, which all work together in very, very complex ways. And until recently, most of this was very obscure. But as science advances, and particularly it's with AI, the ability to use AI, which is a very sophisticated form of pattern recognition, and you can get literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of genomes collected from individuals, and then you collect all the other information about them, everything you can know about their physical, psychiatric, social status. And then you do large calculations using AI to work out what are the patterns that predict particular outcomes. And it's still by no means an exact science. This is very much a probabilistic exercise of saying that if you have this particular pattern, we crunch the numbers and we work out you have a probability, this embryo in subsequent life has a probability X, Y, Z of different conditions.
And is this just kind of theory that we could now do, or is it actually happening? Are there actually IVF clinics that will offer parents the chance to say, well, you've got 20 embryos, embryo A is 50% likely to have diabetes, and embryo B is 30% likely to develop skin cancer, and you choose based on this?
Well, in the UK, this is not currently happening, but it's interesting that in the USA, although there is strict regulation of what happens in government-funded research and government-funded establishments, there's very little or virtually no regulation of what happens in private IVF clinics. And it seems very much that it's commercial issues which dominate. In other words, you can have pretty much almost anything that you like if you're prepared to pay for it. And so stimulated my interest was this a paper which we're going to link to in the chat notes called Public Attitudes, Interests and Concerns Regarding Polygenic Embryo Screening, and just published in the paper JAMA Network, which is a very prestigious medical journal. And according to this report, it is already occurring in a number of clinics. So it's already commercially available, and it's currently unregulated as to the types of polygenic outcomes that can be screened.
And so the research is here. Basically did a big survey of US adults to try and find out what did people think about polygenic embryo screening. How do they feel about it? Would they want it for themselves? Were there any guardrails or rules that they think should be imposed? And what did they find?
Yes, and this in itself is a very interesting development in the understanding of medical ethics or bioethics, and the way that bioethics is carried out in Western societies, which is that very often in these kind of ethical discussions, it doesn't focus on fundamental philosophical, psychological, sociological factors, but it's very often, you know, the default position is, well, let's ask people, let's get a democratic view of people's opinions, because in the end, we can't agree amongst ourselves about what are the philosophical and fundamental issues. And so the best way is simply to ask a sample of the electorate and say, well, what do you think? Would you be prepared to have this? Would you be prepared to have it for physical health conditions, for psychiatric health conditions? What about selecting embryos for behavioral traits or for physical traits like height and so on. And their conclusion was, you know, having sampled over 1,000 people, that a majority were in favor of it, using it for physical health conditions, apparently 77%, and for psychiatric health conditions, 72%, but only a minority for behavioral and physical traits.
And there was, interesting to me, when they were asked, if you were undergoing IVF, would you be interested? Something like 82% said that they would be interested in it. You know, so more than four in five people said if they were undergoing IVF, they would consider, if it was offered, they would consider doing this kind of genetic embryo screening. But it says, nevertheless, concerns about the screening leading to false expectations and promoting eugenic practices were quite pronounced, with 55% of people finding them very to extremely concerning.
Yeah. And but then in an interesting twist, and, you know, this is the USA, so they then say, well, OK, how much are you prepared to pay? You know, if we could offer you this kind of screening, but it's going to cost you. And it's, the paper says rather dryly, the responses range from $0 to $100,000, with the mean willingness to pay being $3,240.
So I guess people are at least vaguely aware of the that this might have ethical concerns around, you know, eugenics and things like that. But basically, people are up for it, and on average, would be prepared to pay $3,000, more than $3,000, to give themselves the opportunity. I suppose this comes in the context of if you're already doing IVF, which in most instances you would be costing you tens of thousands of dollars anyway. Maybe it's less of a stretch to then say, well, let's pay a little premium on the price of that to try and be able to select what my future son or daughter will be like.
Yeah, although actually in the study population, they weren't selected on the basis they were all doing IVF. My understanding is they were just a random selection of the population.
So, nationally representative, yeah.
Yes, so but of course you're right. In reality, people are paying a lot of money. If you're having IVF, particularly in the States, it's extremely expensive, and so you'll be in that context. You know, a few thousand dollars would be a relatively small extra additional sum to pay, and I mean, it's interesting sort of stepping back from this, because, you know, here's another science fiction idea that's been around for a long time. I think we mentioned previously the film Gattaca.
Yes.
Which I think is 20 years.
Yeah, it's the 90s, more than 20 years ago, a long time ago.
20 years ago. So fascinating to see that often these ethical questions have been raised and discussed. And it's a film which is still worth watching. Again, we can put the details in the show notes, because it raises very well, you know, a postulated future where this kind of screening is universal.
Yeah.
And then all the issues that it leads to.
Yeah. And even further back, you know, I recently reread the Aldous Huxley novel Brave New World, which is written in the 1930s, is it, or the 20s? You know, so almost a century ago. But it again postulates a future society in which, this is obviously before IVF was a thing, but in which all reproduction is done kind of mechanistically, industrially, rather than through natural pregnancy, and in which the kind of state, kind of quasi benevolent dictatorship state, very aggressively selects traits to kind of stratify society into these predetermined classes, you know. So they make some people smart and they give them all the elite jobs, make some people strong and give them all the manual labor jobs and that kind of thing. And this is seen as like actually, you know, developing happiness for everyone, so everyone is best suited for the task that they've been given. And so this is an idea, as you say, that sci-fi has been exploring for a long time, and we might really be on the cusp of it becoming reality. Though I have to say, I did note in the paper, it does point out that studies demonstrate that while this technology is feasible, it has substantial limitations due to the correlational nature of polygenic scores and their low predictive power, and the variable performance across environments, populations, which is, I think, is kind of science mumbo jumbo speak for basically saying it's not clean cut. You can't simply say you've got these four genes, you will be tall, because like genetics doesn't work like that. And often it's just a kind of you have a 15% chance of being more tall than the average, but that doesn't really mean the thing, does it?
Yeah, well, and of course this is, so you know, there are so many interesting factors here. One is just the pure science of genetics, you know, and this is often described as genetic determinism, that you, that what your DNA is basically determines who, what's every aspect of your life, and that's just bad science, because so much of modern science of genetics and biology has shown that it's an interaction between your genome and your environment. And interestingly, that even starts in the womb. So, right, you know, you're already in the womb in a particular environment, and that environment is changing you. So even identical twins who share an absolutely identical genome have different environments in the womb, subtly different environments, and that accounts for some of the differences between identical twins. But certainly, as you then go through life, you're exposed to a complete range of different environmental factors, infections and nutrition and stress and everything else that happens to you, accidents and so on. And all of these interact with your genome. So biologically, you're never going to be able to have 100% prediction. And yet, nonetheless, diseases and conditions vary according to their degree of prediction. So you can have some things where there does seem to be a virtual 100% prediction. I mean, Huntington's disease, it appears that if you have the genetic evidence, you know, picked up even as an embryo, then you have a very high chance of developing the condition. So the inheritability, the degree of inheritability between different conditions varies a lot. Whereas you have other things where the correlation is much weaker. So the polygenic screening is always going to be only predictive. But just to go back to Aldous Huxley, one of the fascinating things is that in that pre-war era, a kind of hard eugenics was very common. Lots and lots of people were concerned about the genetic health of the population. They were particularly concerned that people who had poor genetics were having far too many children, whereas the elite with their good genetics were not having enough children. This is a constant theme which comes back time and time again in the history of humanity. And so, you know, we're going to have to lend a factor. We're going to have to improve the genetic health. We're going to have to stop people with bad genes having children and so on. And of course, after the horrors of the Nazi era and all that genetic mumbo jumbo about racial purity and so on, there was a kind of horror against eugenics, and it all goes quiet for decades. But now it's come back again. But the commentators and philosophers are very keen to say, no, this is soft genetics, eugenics. This is not state saying you must, you cannot, we will sterilize you. This is all about choice. This is all about freedom. It's all about autonomy. And of course you're free. Yes, it's eugenics, but it's eugenics with a human face, with an about liberalism and autonomy. Mm-hmm.
And this again is a strong theme in the Gattaca film, whereby you know, parents do have the choice in this future state to reject the screening and to kind of go au naturel and just roll the genetic dice and see what happens. And that happens very occasionally. But those people inevitably, because they're a tiny minority and because there's a kind of genetic snobbery involved, they are massively persecuted and oppressed and stigmatized, and they live as a kind of underclass in the society. And, you know, no law has been passed compelling parents to do this. But when 99% of parents take up the chance to kind of mold their perfect super child, obviously they all do. And so only a few weirdos and freaks don't. And so even without the kind of state compulsion, it still ends up in an incredibly unjust, oppressive society in which those who, you know, previously did something that was seen as completely normal, just had a child the old-fashioned way and see and saw what, you know, the random mixture of sperm and egg threw up, was now seen as like a profoundly antisocial decision. Why would you do that? Why would you abandon the chance to control and select and mold the perfect child?
And it does raise, challenging questions, both so that there's societal questions about, you know, is this something for the common good? And if we have concerns about it from a societal point of view, do we feel so strongly that we should outlaw it? Should we say this is simply unacceptable? Would it be possible to outlaw it? I mean, again, you know, we've talked about reproductive tourism before. You can get sex, or even though sex selection is outlawed in the UK, you can go elsewhere in the world, have sex selection of your embryos, and then come back to the UK and have your child. So you know, is it possible? Would it be possible to outlaw it? Is question number one. But then question number two, I think, from a Christian point of view, is to what extent do we think it's appropriate to use choice and our intelligence and in order to select children or maybe to minimize risk, you know, because the argument goes, you know, if we can select for a condition, if we can reduce the risk of my child having, I don't know what, type 1 diabetes or some severe allergic condition or developing cancer in early childhood, would it be appropriate for me as a Christian to use this technology? I'm not selecting the perfect child. I'm simply using caution and wisdom and modern science to minimize risk. Is that any different from me paying for house insurance, for instance, or for other forms of insuring, you know, health insurance, insuring myself against disasters in the future?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think you're right that a lot of Christians are instinctively recoil from this, but maybe couldn't exactly explain why. And I think we need to engage seriously with the argument that, you know, why wouldn't you want to live in a world in which there were fewer babies being born with a propensity to type 1 diabetes or a propensity to breast cancer or propensity to, you know, or, you know, why wouldn't you want a child who had a higher likelihood of being intelligent? You know, that's an unalloyed good to be more intelligent, right? Everyone would agree with that. What's the harm? And I guess it comes down to what is your kind of theology of children, and about, as we talked before in the podcast, to what extent are they to be received as gift, and to what extent are they a creation? Are they procreation? To what extent are you reproducing, or are these actually God's creations that we are receiving as gift, and it's not for us to meddle and interfere and to try and exercise more agency over their construction from the raw materials of the universe? And I think there is certainly a strong biblical case to say that, you know, God makes children, not us. And the parents' role is to kind of welcome them into the family unconditionally.
Yeah. And this is where the whole selection element really is challenging, isn't it? Because the very technique of creating multiple embryos and then selecting them, even the way that it's done at the moment, selecting good embryos and discarding bad embryos, has immediately is now instrumentalizing this bundle of cells. This is now a product which I am assessing,
commodifying,
and giving it grades out of 10. You know, and the question is that an appropriate thing for one human being to do to another human being? Or are we, by that very process of selecting human beings to come into the world, going outside our creaturely you know, bounds. And this is something which Christians definitely differ quite profoundly on. You know, and it's probably for people who've read anything I've written before, they're not too surprised that I come down on the conservative, if ultimately I would come down on the conservative side, so-called. I'm a bio-conservative, if not a neo-Luddite, and if not a deathist and all that. You know, but I would say in the end, I would come to caution to conservatism and then say it's inappropriate to do any kind of selection. But I have many Christian scientist colleagues and medical colleagues who would argue differently, and they would say God has given us this scientific insight for a reason, and we don't just shut our eyes. We do it, yes, we have the right to choose, but we must do it wisely and within limits. And they would certainly, my Christian colleagues would draw a clear distinction between selecting for positive characteristics and selecting against diseases, but they would say that selecting against diseases is part of what God has given us this technology for.
I think part of the reason why I struggle with this is because I feel like there's a bit of an almost deliberate kind of elision of what's really going on here, because we often talk about, you know, well, why wouldn't you want to stop diabetes and these horrible diseases, which obviously we're all on board with, but that's actually not what's going on here. We don't at the moment have the ability pre-conception to prevent embryos developing that have these diseases. So what we're really doing is we're saying, let's generate lots of children and then let's pick the ones that seem healthy and discard the rest. Which if we did that post-birth, if we said to a family, have 10 kids, carry them to term, and then when they're born, as they grow up, we'll figure out which are the three best and we'll kill the seven others, would be seen as a horrific, horrific crime. But ultimately, when we wind the clock back to several weeks old and say, have 10 embryos, pick the best three and discard, freeze, destroy, whatever other ambiguous term you want to use the others, it seems as more positive. You know, if we generally had a way to say, before the sperm and egg have even fused, let's give the mother a drug, which means that for some reason, the bad sperm won't get there. And so, you know, I'd be, sign me up. That seems like a good technology to try and prevent diseases. But what we can't do that. So what we're actually doing is saying, let's create lots of children and then filter out the bad ones and only carry to term the good ones, which I think is quite a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the way the argument is presented by many people on the pro-life banner. I have to say, I have a bit of a problem with that formulation. Because of the equation of an embryo with a child, you're basically saying, you know, what you've got in the dish there is 10 children, and you're selecting one child from, and they're not children. You know, I have argued previously, and I do again, that the embryo is sui generis. It is neither a blob of jelly nor is it a child. A person. It is some strange unformed human which is halfway in between, which is different from both. And that because we know that up to 50% of those beings are not destined to become children anyway. Because
largely because they carry genetic flaws and errors in their genetic
they carry many of them very massive genetic abnormalities. But it's also true that just the rate of early miscarriage is quite significant. And, you know, if you were seriously saying, you know, we're about to undergo a process in which, you know, we're going to generate children and a quarter of them are going to die, you would say, stop. You know, you're killing children. Don't do it. Don't do it. And yet we don't do that. We encourage people, you know, and the Bible encourages married couples to have regular intercourse and to bring children into the world and so on. So, in other words, there is a mystery here. There's something about embryonic life which is a mystery, and it's a bit too simple to say that they're all children in a tube. They're not. But the other thing, I think, just at the way I would think about it, is that embryos are actually designed to be hidden within the fallopian tube. That's the way God made us. You know, you never saw your you know, the psalmist says your eyes saw my unformed being, but nobody else did. I mean, it was completely hidden. Now we're all, this is done under the glare of the microscope. Apparently in some IVF clinics in the States, where else, actually I think it happens somewhere else as well, you can watch your embryos growing from the comfort of your own home. There's a microscope and a camera,
like a webcam,
a
microscope webcam, so to check in on your embryos on your phone.
And never out of your. So
what,
you know,
a world!
This is slightly different from the what is being woven together in the depths of the earth. You know, in Psalm 139. So these are complex and painful issues. But I think, and in the end, Christians have differed and no doubt will continue to differ. In the end, we must do what we think is right. My own view is that genetic screening before birth, including of the embryo, is a kind of commodification of the child. The only justification, I think, is, as you say, if there's some kind of therapeutic benefit. If by doing a genetic screen, I can identify a problem and then give the embryo something which is going to make it do better, then yes, this is now therapeutic medicine and it's a good thing to do. But if the only option, the only treatment I have is that you're not going to be selected, then that seems to me to go beyond something that's appropriate.
And it has echoes to me in some of the way it's talked about with which we've covered on the podcast before, the whole question around neonatal screening for things like Down syndrome. And people saying, you know, wouldn't you want to live in a world in which we've eradicated Down syndrome? But that's actually obscuring the fact that we haven't. Just as many babies are born with trisomy 23 or 28, whatever it is, the chromosomal abnormality that causes Down syndrome, as ever were. The reason why rates of Down syndrome people have disappeared in some countries like Iceland and Denmark is because they're being almost universally aborted. And so, and I'm not saying that's equivalent necessarily to fetal screening and selection, but I think it's important that we speak clearly and truthfully about what we're doing. And people deliberately obfuscate the reality that they've made no progress whatsoever in preventing the chromosomal abnormality. We've just got much better at figuring out and stopping them from ever being born. And I think we need to make sure that we speak clearly about what we're doing here in selection. Is we're not actually treating diabetes, we're just preventing people who could get diabetes from being born.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the number of conceptions of with Down syndrome is relatively unchanged, and this is the distinction which epidemiologists would talk about: primary prevention. Primary prevention is when you stop the condition itself, you prevent the condition. Secondary prevention is when you are treating it in some way, so that the consequences are less. And of course, this is a very troubling kind of secondary prevention, because you're basically preventing people from coming into existence, continuing their existence. So challenging stuff.
And you have to wonder what kind of society, you know, if we could, in a world where, you know, the Gattaca style, we did completely kind of through genetic selection eradicate a lot of this variation. Even eradicating bad stuff, like what kind of society is that when everyone is fit, healthy, well, there is no brokenness, there is no fallenness, there is no sense of frailty. I don't know. It's a kind of Nietzschean vision of kind of overcoming all things. And I know that's kind of a vision of heaven in some ways, but yeah, I just feel slightly wary about what kind of culture we create where there aren't the weak anymore because everyone is strong. I don't know. Probably beyond the scope of this conversation, but...
But no, I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing I would say is this fascinating thing that godlike knowledge leads to godlike responsibility. That because we didn't have this knowledge before, it wasn't a problem. Now, you know, science offers us this godlike knowledge. But once you have that knowledge, you've got responsibility. How do you use it wisely?
I I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now, we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of the ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000, and so I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help to keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital, so please give your best gift today, knowing that your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Right, shall we move on to our second story? This is a news story, an exclusive news story in The Guardian here in the UK, which is headlined, "Brain damage to babies in birth has cost the NHS in England £4.1 billion in lawsuits." The NHS has spent £4.1 billion over just the last 11 years settling lawsuits involving babies who suffered brain damage when being born amid claims that maternity units are not learning from mistakes. And this particularly interests me, not only because I think it's an interesting question, but because I'm aware that a significant part of your work is involved in these very cases as an expert witness around brain damage to premature babies, which is kind of your medical specialism. So do you want to just explain a little bit about how that works and your perspectives on this Guardian story?
Yeah, so as you say, this is very close to home for me, partly because, you know, I spent 30 years working in medicine as a research scientist and clinician, particularly concerned about brain damage in infant babies and trying to find new ways of treating brain injury. And I've now retired from actively working on the front line, but I still have a part-time role acting as an expert witness in cases like this, in cases where there is a dispute between hospital staff and parents as to whether or not mistakes and inadequate care around the time of birth contributed to the tragedy of a child either being dying or being permanently injured. And you know, it reminds me to perhaps just say right up front, you know, we're talking about a deeply personal topic, and it's very likely there are some people listening to this podcast who have watched and have had painful experiences to do with childbirth, possibly leading to brain damage or death or so on. And so, you know, I'm very painfully aware of how this touches so many people. And, you know, I've had the experience over decades of trying to support parents following an absolute catastrophe at childbirth. And that's perhaps one of the first things to say, and that is that it's easy for us in society as a whole to get the impression that childbirth is a perfectly normal, natural process, a bit like shelling peas, you know, and it's... And the truth is that although, thankfully, due to advances in obstetric and neonatal care, the vast majority of children and mothers survive the process and do extremely well, it is still an astonishingly nasty and dangerous business, which can lead to tragic outcomes.
Yeah, very often due to a deprivation of oxygen during labour. But it can be very, as you say, very devastating to have cerebral palsy or some other form of brain injury. And often the reason the parents are effectively suing the NHS is not just because they're kind of angry and hurt, but also because the cost of lifelong care for a profoundly disabled child as they grow up, who might need 24-hour care and specialist equipment and that stuff, can reach, you know, up to 10, 15, 20 million pounds. And so for most parents, obviously, they don't have that kind of money. And so kind of suing the NHS in a lawsuit is not just a question of getting justice, but is a question of like, how am I going to provide for the child who through a few minutes maybe of oxygen deprivation or something else is left with potentially 50, 60, 70 years of intensive care needs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it is sadly true that children born around term who do suffer this, the worst kinds of oxygen deprivation around birth, can be tragically and catastrophically damaged with very severe cerebral palsy affecting all four limbs, so they're totally dependent on care. Sometimes very severe learning difficulties, sometimes visual and hearing impairment, behavioural difficulties, seizures, and so on. I mean, it is really catastrophic to see the tragic consequences sometimes. I mean, amazingly, a therapy that I was involved in which is hypothermia, what we and colleagues demonstrated was there was a window of opportunity. If you could start the intervention just within less than 6 hours of the baby being born, you could substantially, in some cases, substantially reduce the severity of the brain damage, meaning that there was a significant reduction in both the numbers who died and those who were severely disabled. But it still only is effective for a minority of babies, unfortunately, and we're still looking for other protective treatments to add to the hypothermia to see whether it could be improved further.
And the kind of core premise of this article is that the Guardian has basically done freedom of information request to extract this figure of 4.1 billion spent settling lawsuits about brain damage of babies over the last 11 years. They say this is evidence that there's a kind of growing crisis of poor care across NHS childbirth services. You know, basically, if NHS wasn't so bad at looking after babies, they wouldn't be having to shell out so much money in compensation. Do you buy that claim, or do you think actually, just irrespective, there will always be mistakes, there will always be accidents, some babies will get brain damaged? This is not necessarily a sign the NHS is bad at it.
Well, it's certainly true that that of all areas of modern medicine, this must be one of the areas in which the stakes are highest, where literally failing to get a baby out 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes late can lead to catastrophic consequences. And as you say, as much as 10 million plus pounds for the long-term care needs. And there really isn't very few other areas of medicine where it's quite that critical. And so even with the most brilliantly operating medical services, nursing, midwifery, and so on, tragically, there are always going to be, nobody is going to be able to operate at 100% in that kind of tiger country. And yet, I think the basic message is right, that a lot of this could be very significantly reduced if the care that was offered to pregnant mothers was substantially improved. But there's not an easy quick fix there. So there are several factors. One factor is there is a particularly British preoccupation with so-called natural childbirth, and I have to use my words with care here because I'm going into tiger country because natural childbirth sounds such a positive, and so the argument goes, this isn't a disease. Pregnancy is not a disease. It's a natural process. It's part of normal humanity. And what's happened is those terrible doctors and the scientists have medicalized the whole process and turned it into a scientific quagmire. And if we could only get back to the natural and allow the wisdom of nature and the wisdom of the body, then we wouldn't have these kind of problems. And I'm afraid, you know, all the evidence is that that simply is not true. And slightly cruelly, you know, when I'm confronted with people who say that kind of thing, my response is, if you really believe that, go to some areas in rural sub-Saharan Africa and you will see what natural childbirth is like. And it is still true that in some areas of rural sub-Saharan Africa, where there are very limited facilities, that maternal mortality can be as high as 1 in 20, 1 in 25 childbirths, and baby mortality can be higher than that, you know, 1 in 10. And that is effectively what childbirth without medical intervention looks like and has always been like.
And I'm very painfully aware that we're two men talking about this who've never been pregnant, and so trying to tread carefully. But I guess the response, or what I, when I've spoken to lots of mothers about this, is that there is an unhealthy culture of kind of paternalism from a mostly male medical establishment that wants to kind of control women's fertility and insist that they unnecessarily medicalized, and that actually labor is a much more pleasant experience and therefore safer and more comfortable for the baby as well if the woman is potentially in her own home and it's led by midwives, not by doctors, and it's not surrounded by beeping machines in a noisy hospital. And yes, of course, there'll be some cases where there are risks, but if you're a low risk pregnancy, the evidence suggests that you are just as safe giving birth in a birthing pool at home with a female midwife there and minimal medical intervention. We don't need to kind of go full hammer and tongs for 99% of pregnancies.
And the evidence is, by and large, that's true. If you very carefully select mothers to ensure that they are as low risk as possible, and you have a trained midwife, and you have delivery at home or in a birthing unit, that most of the time that will work extremely well, and that the baby will be born without any problems at all. Everybody recognizes that there's a significant minority where problems arise during the labor. There's problems with the baby's heart, or the baby passes meconium, or other things. And then everyone agrees the right thing to do is to transfer the baby to hospital. The problem is the rare emergencies, which are absolutely catastrophic. And the problem is that someone like me, because of my day job, has seen that on a regular basis. And I have seen the completely shell-shocked parents saying, "Doctor, if I'd only known, if someone had warned me this was a possibility, I would never have made those decisions. But nobody spelled out to me what would happen if my baby got stuck. Because what happens if you know, in the worst case, the baby's got stuck and you're at home, is that it is simply not possible to gate that baby out before permanent brain damage has occurred. It, you know, because we're talking about 5, 10, 15 minutes.
So even if you call an ambulance, they won't get you to the hospital in time.
They can't get you there in time. And similarly, if the mother has a catastrophic hemorrhage, and you only have to see one mother with a catastrophic hemorrhage, when it, you know, I mean, use your imagination. You can lose half your blood volume in a few minutes, and you imagine that happening at home. And again, you know, is it going to be possible to get the mother, you know, to get the drip in, to get the crash emergency blood, to get the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So that's the problem. The question is, how do we balance those risks against the advantages of having all the positive psychological advantages? And there is a solution, and the solution is have a birthing unit in the hospital adjacent to all the surgical ITU pathology resources you need. And that means that if the catastrophe happens, within 5 minutes you can be in the operating theatre and the team are all there. So there is a solution, and I think most of the time that works very well. But then the other side of the point is that you do need to have a 24/7 system with depth, because it means, you know, sadly these emergencies don't happen very neatly, one every 6 hours. They happen, two happen simultaneously, and so all of a sudden we need two operating theatres, and we need two surgeons, and we need two anaesthetists, and we need two emergency blood supplies, and so on. So you've got to have depth and resilience, and that's the reason why we've moved towards bigger and bigger major units rather than lots and lots of small district general hospitals.
And so when you are, you know, because another point made in the article is that astonishingly, when the regulator who inspects NHS services, it's called the Care Quality Commission, they have rated 2/3 of maternity units in England as unsafe, which astonishes me, and I'm not a pregnant mother awaiting to give birth in one of these units. Do you think there is a crisis in maternity care, and that maybe these brain damage ones are the extreme cases, but actually in general we're not doing well at kind of delivering babies and keeping mothers safe?
I do, I'm afraid, and anybody who's particularly in the postnatal wards, I mean, by and large on labour ward and in the delivery suite, pretty good care is maintained in most centres around the world, around the country. But certainly outside of the delivery suite, it often seems, both in the antenatal ward and in the postnatal ward, staffing levels are much lower, and the kind of level of supervision and care that's going on is often poor. And the reason for this is pretty clear. It is that hospital managers are on a complete double bind. They are being told the care is inadequate, you must do something. Oh, but there's no more money. Sorry. You know, you have a fixed budget. You are not allowed to spend any more money. You will be held account if you go over into the red. So, you know, your problem is to conjure miracles out of thin air, and made worse by then all the staffing problems that have happened to do with the pandemic, to do with increased sickness among staff, increased burnout. Made worse by the fact that you've then got a growth of agencies, nursing and midwifery agencies and medical agencies, that are charging literally obscene amounts to the NHS for someone to do an extra shift. And quite a lot of nurses and midwives then going with agencies because it's much more,
makes them much more money
financially. Sense, and I can choose, I've got control, I can say yes, I can say no, I'll fix it according to exactly as I need it. I mean, what's not to like compared with the rigors of working for the... So there's all kinds of perverse incentives, complexities of a nationalized health service.
Do you ever, when you're doing these cases and you're, you know, poring over the medical files and reading what the doctors and nurses did, do you ever kind of hold your head in your hands and just think, this was just a cock up, this was just incompetent, this was just, I would never have done that, why on earth did you not do that or do that, you are the reason to blame for this child's life being ruined?
Well, it's terribly easy for someone like me to come on, and sometimes I'm coming 5 years, even 10 years after the event, and poring over the records and saying, you know, hopeless record keeping, and for goodness sake, there's 10 minutes here, 10 minutes! What were they doing, you know? But I do constantly remind myself about what was it like, because I've been there on the other side many, many times. And of course, what's not in the notes is what else was happening, that at the same time there was a complete catastrophe happening in another part of the hospital, which they were responsible for dealing with. Oh, and also there was someone hadn't come in because they'd called in sick. We actually had reduced staffing on that day. And we were all scrabbling around with the best will in the world, trying to cover, and we just managed to keep it going. And then this disaster happened, and so on and so on. So, you know, it's often called the Swiss cheese model, that disasters don't go wrong because of one person making a mistake. disasters go, you know, that happen because of a whole succession of failures of the system, that the backup and the redundancy and the extra staffing and the ability to cope with unexpected, all of those things failed, and then bang, you end up with a disaster. So it's rarely the person on the front line who is to blame. You know, yes, they made a mistake. Why did they make a mistake? They made a mistake because of X, Y, Z. And I have to say, the industry which has really demonstrated that it is possible to make a difference is the airline industry, because, you know, getting into a plane used to be like childbirth. You know, you weren't quite sure whether you'd walk out the other end, whereas now it has become an astonishingly safe way of getting around. And the reason for that has not happened by accident. It has happened by an extraordinary emphasis on safety at every possible point, and unpicking disasters. Whenever disaster happens in the airline industry, they are unpicked with the most extraordinary level of detail, and then money is thrown at it in order to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And the safety culture in the airline industry is very impressive, and it includes things like anonymous reporting, where pilots can anonymously report near misses, including their own mistakes. And there's a lot to learn for the health service from that safety conscious approach.
And just lastly then, I guess a core tenet of this whole idea is that, you know, the NHS is paid for by us, the taxpayer. And so we are sharing the risk of this, of the kind of medical negligence or catastrophes or disasters or whatever. And that, you know, that £1 billion is fundamentally being redistributed to these parents from the pockets of taxpayers. Is that a good system to kind of pool the risk across the whole country? Is there a better way, a fairer way to kind of manage compensating for medical problems? Does it avoid the kind of accountability for the hospital itself?
Yeah, two responses to that. Number one is, why is it that maternity is a kind of Cinderella area within the NHS? Because I could show you other areas which are working far, far better compared to maternity. And I think, sadly, the reason is that there are very skewed pressures from the general public. You know, in a democratic society, especially as you say, we're all paying for it, pressures get pushed on certain areas. And I'm afraid it's the elderly, articulate, upper middle class voters who put enormous pressure on the health service, demanding better treatment for elderly diseases. And it's things like cancer. You know, we demand the latest and most expensive treatments, which are going to cost hundreds of thousands of pounds and might extend our elderly lives by a few weeks or months at the most. But we are absolutely outraged that this most expensive cancer treatment is not being made available on the NHS. And so there's a huge amount of skewed, I think we, as an NHS, we spend far too much money on very rare but highly political conditions, and whereas childbirth is just, you know, it's
humdrum, run of the mill.
Yeah, okay, we need more midwives, blah de blah de blah. So,
it's not sexy.
It doesn't attract people. It's not a vote winner. It's not, and I think that's really unfortunate. You know, that we put such emphasis into rare but high profile diseases. But the second interesting question is whether you should take this out of litigation completely. And there have been attempts in some countries to bring in a no fault compensation. Which it varies in different countries, but basically any child who appears to be brain damaged and who might have been brain damaged during birth. You don't have to prove the case. You simply have a kind of report by somebody that says, yes, it could have been something happens at birth, and the government will pay out. But what happens in those schemes is that the government pays out much, much less. Surprise, surprise. It's often something like £50,000 or £100,000, because there are far, far more cases. That turn out to be, for every in the UK system, for every one that goes all the way and is receives a large sum of money, there are going to be maybe 10 cases that where in the end it turns out it couldn't have been avoided. So that's the first problem. And then you're also dividing. So what about a congenital abnormality? So now my baby's got catastrophic problems because of congenital malformation, but I don't get any money. Or maybe the government should pay me £100,000 and so on and so on. So I think all these schemes are not easy, and that there's no simple solution. But as a society, surely it does concern us to try to do the very best for our children and for the next generation, and that maybe some of us old grey hairs are going to have to accept that in the interest of society as a whole, we're going to have to forego some of the most cutting-edge and expensive treatments in order to give the next generation the best chance.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it strikes me that there is a different way, which would, you know, this whole problem comes because, you know, if you have a child who is profoundly disabled, it could be, you know, you could bankrupt you, right? Whereas, and that's why parents have to sue the NHS to squeeze the money out to pay for their child's care, when really I would like to live in a society in which all people with profound disabilities, the state shared a large portion of the cost of the care, potentially means tested with the ability of the parents to pay, whether it was caused by negligence, whether it was caused by a random genetic quirk that was no one's fault. It should be based on your need rather than requiring you to, you know, compel the taxpayer to compel the NHS trust to lose hundreds of millions of its revenue for treating patients. And it just seems a slightly backwards way round, because as you say, there are lots of times when people need care, they can't afford it, but there's no one to blame, and who then picks up the tab then?
Yeah, and it has been frequently suggested, because of course the NHS does provide support for severely disabled children. There are state provision in the UK. It's not very different from the States, for instance, but it's not as good as it could be, and so there's a quirk of British law which says that when we are calculating the costs to reimburse parents, we don't take into account NHS provision. We say you buy the whole thing completely private, and we ignore the fact that actually the state is providing some of this already. So people have said, wouldn't it be better to take that money and spread it in the whole area to ensure that all disabled children get better care, rather than a few children get gold standard care, and then the rest get fairly bog standard, ordinary care. So yeah, immensely complex,
complicated,
fascinating.
Yeah. Where kind of health policy intersects with kind of government spending policy, and trying to figure out what is fair across the whole population at large, and for the individual families, and for the medical profession. Yeah, very challenging. All right, well, let's call it quits there. Thanks, Dad, as always, for a particular expertise in this one. If you are a medical negligence lawyer looking for an expert witness on brain damage in babies, Professor John White charges very reasonable rates.
I'm not available.
Thanks everyone for listening. Please do carry on sending in your questions or your news stories or scientific research you'd like us to respond to. You can email molad@premier.org.uk, and there's also plenty of resources on lots of kind of ethical dilemmas around the start of life on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.